Our next case is State v. Russell. Again, State v. Russell. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, members of the court. My name is Jerry Soucy. I appear here on behalf of Darnell Russell, the appellant in this case. This is an appeal out of Douglas County involving the denial of an evidentiary hearing and a post-conviction motion. This was a court. This was an attorney-prepared motion for post-conviction relief. I was the attorney. It does not involve a pro se application in which I might have come in later. The proceedings on this revolved around state's motion to dismiss. At that motion to dismiss hearing, the state attempted to present three documents regarding rulings on the motion to suppress and other cases. And the judge kind of accepted that and said, you're going to lose the motion to suppress anyway. As I read the brief, the state takes a different position when it got to the attorney to this level of appeal. And although they don't mention it, they seem to suggest that consideration of evidence in that manner is not appropriate under the Post-Conviction Act. And I think they may be correct on that. If it's going to be an evidentiary hearing, then it's an evidentiary hearing for everybody. It's not an evidentiary hearing just for the attorney, for the state of Nebraska. And I think it is also important, and I didn't assign it as error because I didn't believe it was error because I brought it up on the way the case was disposed of. But if you go back into the original application for post-conviction relief, I referred to the limitations, I believe it's like on paragraphs 43, 44 about attachment one, in that it was something that my client had not seen and it was subject to a discovery limitation under the Nebraska statutes. And so that when I made those allegations of fact regarding what was in that document, I had to, I think, be cautious. And it would have required additional proceedings in terms of whether those could be shared with the client and then whether I could be more specific. And I think I pushed the envelope in terms of how specific I was in the factual allegations.
Yes, so there's a summary of paragraphs 1 through 126,
that's
right?
That's right.
And where you carefully went through to try to indicate what was problematic in attachment 1, which was attached to the application for the wiretap.
That's correct.
Right, for your client.
Yes.
My curiosity is, what's in the application itself for your client's wiretap? I don't see any summary of what's contained in that other than where it says that paragraphs 48 through 72 are based on information that came as a result of the wiretap.
It was all reference to information that had been obtained on the first wiretap.
The other two people, right?
The subjects
of attachment one.
Right.
Yeah.
Theoretically.
But how can a court determine whether a motion to suppress should have been considered if we can't even see the application itself? Paragraphs 1 through 47 may contain probable cause.
If I attach the application to my, if I attach that, I'm in violation of the law. I do not have a discovery order. I do not have an authorization from the court. All I can do prior to filing that post-conviction motion is say, this is out here. This is an unusual situation. And
couldn't you have summarized?
I tried.
There's nothing that summarizes paragraphs 1 through 47 or what happens after paragraph 72.
Well, the first part, I summarize them saying they're boilerplate. Anybody's seen a wiretap application, you know, half of it comes out of every other single wiretap application you've ever seen.
Well, the attachment is a wiretap application, right? It has 126
right.
paragraphs.
But really, when you cut to the nuts and bolts of it, it will be where the particular individual who's being wiretapped, maybe they're on a controlled by, maybe they drove by their house, maybe they have a confidential informant, maybe that information is stale. That's the dilemma that you sort of face when you're filling out this post-conviction motion where you don't have that document part of the record. This could have been fixed.
Would it not be possible, though, to file a motion? I mean, if you have these concerns, when you file your original application, would it not be possible to file some kind of motion so that you can get this, get these actual applications in front of the court, even if it's in some kind of sealed fashion? Because I'm taking it that you, I mean, you're telling us what's wrong with them, so you have access to them. Presumably the state has access to them. So why not get those things in front of the court rather than your rendition of what's in them?
Well, because the state did exactly the same thing I'm afraid of, is that they did not offer those affidavits at the motion to dismiss, which should cause you some pause as to why they think it was okay where they don't offer it. And I don't think they can, and I think they recognize the problem where you can't supplement the files and records of the case on your motion to dismiss, just as I can't supplement the record with stuff outside of the record in my motion for post-conviction relief.
There have been cases, though, heard by the Nebraska Supreme Court in which documents have been attached to a post-conviction motion.
It's probably me.
and have been reviewed by the Supreme Court when considering that appeal.
But in those cases, they've been attached, certainly in my case, they've been attached to my case as part of my allegations of fact.
Which you couldn't do here?
Well, I couldn't do it here because it's a privileged document.
But you couldn't have, as Judge Arterburn indicated, sought to seal?
We never got that far.
But did you try to do that particular step of seeking to seal to submit it and put it in front of the court?
The motion that was in front of the court was a motion to dismiss. That was the motion that was under consideration. Had we gotten over that motion to dismiss, absolutely. The next thing I would have done on the motions for discovery and depositions is I wasn't sure I had all the discovery. So if I have all the discovery and it appears to be privileged information, you're absolutely correct. At that point, then I do those sort of steps to cover my situation vis-a-vis the discovery rules of the court and of the statutes. And I've had this situation before where there have been search warrants. And what happens at the trial level, and this is what probably should have happened at this case, is that when the prosecution gets up and say, Officer Jones, did you search the house? Yes, I did. Did you have a search warrant? Yes, I did. The warrant sometimes may or may not come into evidence, but there may not be a motion to suppress. Did you have an affidavit? Yes, I did. What I've seen happen is the affidavit in support of the search warrant gets marked as an exhibit. It's made part of the original trial record, but it doesn't go to the jury. And what was so bizarre about this particular case is they spent several days talking about wiretaps, and nobody ever said, well, gee, what was the wiretap? It should have been marked at the original trial, then it would be in the record, and then we wouldn't have this problem.
Mr. Soucy, I'd like to, I know you're running out of time, and I'd like to get to another issue. The state brings up in their brief the issue of, you seem to be attacking the attachment, which is the prior wiretap application. What standing does your client have to attack the prior
application? Because he's an intercepted party.
Because what?
He was an intercepted party in the first application. If the application's bad and he's intercepted, then he has standing to object to his communication.
He wasn't one of the targeted telephones. He just happened to communicate with one of the targeted telephones.
I'll be the other way around. But, yeah, I mean, that, if you wiretap John Jones and anybody that John Jones talks to gets intercepted and they go, aha, we've discovered Mr. Smith over here. And Mr. Smith can say he never should have had this wiretap in the beginning because the wiretap was no good. I got intercepted surreptitiously, and it's suppressible. It's that simple. Okay. And that's what happened. They're going, it's old Tinker's Devil's Chance, if you'll the baseball analogy. But once you end up having that taint from the first wiretap, everything they're getting out of that flows to everybody else.
But your position is your client would have standing to challenge that other, the targeted...
His interception. Target. His interception and the use of his interception in the wiretap, that is...
Was there evidence at the time of at the trial of his communication in as a result of the first wiretap?
Boy. There were a... I don't know if I can answer that question. I know there were references to these phone calls. I did not parse them out to which was part of the first wiretap. I can't answer that question.
Okay.
I specify in the brief the what they call the pertinent communications.
Okay.
And my expectation, the way the trial went, that yes, some of them were from the first wiretap, but I can't tell you that for a fact.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ralph? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Grab some water.
Sure.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. Russell argues on appeal that the district court erred in denying his post-conviction motion without an evidentiary hearing because, one, it incorrectly relied on Exhibits 1 through 3 in determining that the record was record and files in this case affirmatively refuted his allegations, and two, that his allegations themselves were insufficient to warrant an evidentiary hearing. As set forth in my brief, as I'll discuss here shortly, we think the allegations were insufficient to warrant an evidentiary hearing, and being the case, the district court's order was correct, and we therefore ask you to affirm the judgment below. So basically, that the sufficiency of the allegations, he had one claim that his counsel was ineffective for not filing a motion to suppress evidence obtained from the wiretap of his cell phone. And he claimed that the motion to suppress should have been filed because basically the application was based on the results from two earlier wiretap orders, which he claimed were illegal, defective in various respects. We don't think that the allegations are sufficient to warrant an evidentiary hearing for a couple different reasons. One, as Your Honor pointed out, his whole claim is based on the contents of these applications and then violating various provisions of the law. We don't have the applications in the record.
How do you respond to what he says in terms of it's privileged and he couldn't attach them?
Well, I am not an expert on trial court procedure, but Judge Arterburn, I think, is correct in that that could have been addressed before he ever filed his post-conviction motion. He could have gotten authority to attach it. He could have redacted information that was necessarily privileged or could pose a danger to anybody and still get the gist of the allegations, I think, on what probable cause and what was needed and what was defective with the warrants. So I think that could have been included, and that, again, as Your Honor pointed out and as I pointed out in my brief, there are multiple cases from the Nebraska Supreme Court indicating that attachments to post-conviction motions are more than okay. They're accepted, they're reviewed. I don't see why that wouldn't work here. Without the actual applications, we're taking his version of what they say. We don't know the other paragraphs beyond 48 to 72. And, what
and actually, we don't even know what 48 through 72
no,
say.
No, we
right?
do not. Basically, it's just that those are the results of the prior warrant or prior wiretaps and the conversations obtained. And that's just not enough, in our view, to warrant an evidentiary hearing. As far as the standing objection, that was something that I raised as well, because the underlying claim, again, is really focused on the earlier two wiretap orders, and to show standing, to challenge wiretap based on my review of the relevant case law and statutes, you got to either be a target, you have to be involved in a party to the conversation, or you have to, the conversation had to have occurred on or around your premises, basically. And while he may say now, at argument that he was a party to those conversations, he did not say that in his post-conviction motion. And that's why it's insufficient, because he says he's not a target, and there's no indication beyond that the results of those earlier wiretap orders were the basis for the application for his wiretap. So there's no facts alleged that show standing, and that is what controls, I think, for purposes of whether an evidentiary hearing is warranted.
And that's really with regard to challenging the attachment, but in terms of the application for his own wiretap warrant, there really isn't anything provided to the court, is there?
No. And I pointed that out, too, in my brief, that you know, he's saying that the application for the defendant's wiretap rests basically on these two, but we don't know any paragraphs, and we don't, as you said, pointed out, we don't know 48 to 72, but there's no indication what those other paragraphs or how many paragraphs there are, what that information is. And that's why I keep coming back to, you know, as I'm writing this brief, how can we say the allegations are sufficient? How's a district court supposed to analyze this without the actual applications in the record? And without that, I think the district court properly denied the post-conviction motion without an evidentiary hearing.
District court actually went into quite an extensive discussion of the law with regard to wiretapping, and really it's your position that even the allegations themselves don't sufficient or are
right.
Not sufficient.
Yes. Unless this court has further questions, we ask you to affirm judgment below.
Thank you. And I don't believe Mr. Susi has any time left. Okay. Thank you. The matter is submitted. You're excused. Thank you.
Thank you.